This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
And there's just a short description about this particular group of men, but it says, they understood the times and they knew what to do. And I think, gosh, that wouldn't be great if I understood the times and knew what to do. So maybe that's what we're going to try and do this afternoon. At least help us dig down a little bit more deeply into trying to understand cultural discernment. So what is cultural discernment and how do we actually practice it? Well, what we want to do in essence is sort of get a lay of the land. We want to survey the landscape and try and get a better sense of what's out there. And the frames of reference that I'll have for presentation today could apply for a variety of contexts. So maybe if you're trying to sort of understand American culture, or maybe you're trying to understand your local community, or maybe you're trying to understand the campus where you're located, or maybe you're trying to understand a whole variety of different places. My hope is that what we'll sort of discuss will at least get us moving in that particular direction. How do we understand the times in which we exist? It's important to sort of get a sense of how we actually do this, and perhaps it would be helpful for us to take a little bit of a pop quiz. I spent a number of years working as a consultant for religion and culture to the Gallup Institute, a subsidiary of the Gallup poll. Anyone here been part of a Gallup poll before? Okay, good. A couple of folks. My mom's always wanting me to add her name to the list. She said, I want to give them my ideas. Tell them what I think. It's interesting because Gallup has been asking questions about a whole variety of things. It's the very beginning of scientific polling. Scientific polling began in this country in the 1930s. And they've been asking questions about Americans, about their religious life from the very beginning. For example, one of the questions that they ask is, do you believe in God or higher power? Now, if you were guessing, what percentage of Americans do you think would say they believe in God or higher power? 90%, yeah. Sometimes it's as high as 96%. But you can't appreciate that data point until you realize that our closest counterpart in all cross-national studies, if you're trying to compare two countries, the United States is oftentimes paired with Great Britain, right? Because we have similar language, although I lived in England for a time, I'd say that it was an experience of cultural dislocation. We were separated by a common language. But we have similar history, similar experiences, those kinds of things. In terms of religion, though, it looks pretty different. In the U.S., for example, and according to recent polls, it's getting darker in here. Maybe they're trying to cool us off a little bit. Pretty soon it'll be the romantic setting for all of us. Anyway, according to recent polls, the percentage of Americans who are atheists or agnostic is at 4%. You know what it is in Great Britain? It's 40%. 40%. There are 10 times the number of self-identified atheists and agnostics in Great Britain as there are in the United States. It's interesting because in the U.S., roughly about 2 in 5 Americans say that they go to church on a weekly basis. Now, I got to tell you, when I'm looking out, leaving our driveway Sunday morning, it doesn't look like 40% of my neighbors are showing up to church. I don't know about you. But that's what they're saying, at least. And that actually is still a meaningful statistic because it allows us to see what percentage of Americans feel the desire to affiliate with a local religious body. If you were guessing, what state would you guess has the highest weekly church attendance? What area of the country is it going to be?
The South.
That's right. All right, so what state would it be?
South Carolina.
I'll give you a hint. Catholics are very good churchgoers. Louisiana. 59% of folks in Louisiana say that they attend church on a weekly basis. What state of the union has the lowest weekly church attendance?
Washington
State. 29% is Washington State. It's interesting, whenever you're looking at statistics, you can find all types of things. I often say the techniques of my discipline is sociology, and if you do a statistical analysis and the results don't support your hypothesis, just add some weights or figures to make it work, right? So this is oftentimes what people do in statistics, and one of the interesting things, today in the newspaper we got outside of our hotel room, USA Today, you look on the front page, anyone have the current USA Today with them? Anyone bring it? Oh, good. Pull it out if you don't mind. Because I was struck by, in the bottom left-hand corner, there's a very interesting tidbit. You know how USA Today, they use all the graphs and pictures and different things. And on the front page, in the bottom corner, it cites USA Today snapshots the decline in believers. Did you notice this? And it is dependent upon a Harris Interactive poll of 2,200 adults conducted in January of 2003 and in November of 2008. It showed in 2003, 90% of Americans said that they believe in God, and today 80% say they believe in God. It says that more Americans believed in heaven, the devil, and in hell in 2003 than in 2008. And if you look at this figure, you would assume we're losing all of our sort of theological beliefs. But you know what? Any sociologist worth his weight knows this probably isn't that accurate. Why? Because it's an interactive poll. What does that mean? It means it's relying upon a certain population. One, population has web access. Another, that same population who had been brought in by this particular company, Harris, which has done polling for a long time, to actually participate in their surveys. What is the key thing whenever you're trying to discern the culture is that you need to also keep in mind that we have to have our full sort of cultural glasses on. And this is one of the great problems in the church, is that we just assume if somebody quotes a statistic, it must be right. 40% of people at InterVarsity are looking for a spouse at following Christ. What do I base that on? Well, I sat down with five people. I asked them if they're looking for a spouse. Two of them were, and so it must be the case, right? That's how some people do polling. Well, that's not what you want. You want to get a much better sense of looking at it. Now, I'm not going to suggest that cultural discernment is simply a matter of us trying to sort of use the methods of social science or whatever it might be to make things work. No, I want to stress that as a follower of Christ, I think prayer ought to be at the very beginning of what we're doing. It ought to undergird every activity we're about and ought to help us as we're trying to make implications. I work with lots of churches and different religious groups who are trying to sort of use the techniques of social science to better understand the context. And the thing I say to them is how long have you been praying about it? Because if you're ready to go into the field with a survey or interviews, it's no good unless you've been praying about it for a while. So prayer is something we want to sort of keep at the center of our attention. And yet at the same time, it only makes sense if every single cultural institution in the world uses the techniques of cultural discernment to better understand customers, businesses, world affairs. Why would we in the church not do that? So what we want to do is sort of harness the techniques of cultural discernment in better ways to understand the times and to know what to do, whether it's our local community, our campus, our vacation, or our country. And so what I want to share with you are some of the just nitty-gritty practical details of how we might actually try and do that. It's interesting if you think about it. Clifford Geertz is an anthropologist who studied tribal people in Bali. And one of the things that he wrote about is how important it is to really get in and understand all of the context of seemingly simple actions, like a week. So we know that a week can convey different types of things. What are some of the things that a week can convey?
Trust.
Skepticism.
Flirting.
Inside knowledge.
Dust.
And that's right. So you've got, if you look at just the physical, manifestation of what happens when we wink, contracting the eyelid, right? So we're just talking about a physical action. And yet, there are all these other things that mean a whole lot more than dust. Trust, romance, all those kinds of ways in which we might sort of understand how things work. And it just so happened that earlier this year, there was some real discussion about winks. You might have remembered this, right? That this has became sort of a part of the context. Something as simple as a wink can convey lots of different things. So here's the point. So what does he teach us about how we try and understand the time? One of the things that he says to us is that you have to differentiate between what he calls thick description and thin description. There's two different things. So this is Anthropology 101. Thick and thin description. What's the difference between that? Well, thin description, if you're looking at a wink,
is you're just going to describe the physical characteristics of what's going on with the eye, rapidly contracting the eyelids, closing the eyelid in a seemingly unusual way. That's just the thin description. That's what you're doing. So in here, in his work, if he just sort of notes that there are people who are doing these different kinds of wink, well, then that's fine. But he says, no, actually, it's a lot more than that. You have to actually understand the symbolic context. Understand what is it that people are trying to communicate by these seemingly simple actions. So a wink is one example of where you've got a physical thing that somebody does that communicates a whole range of different meanings or possibilities. How else can we see that there are things that are around us that people use something to try and communicate? Yes, sir?
What did you say before?
This is Geertz, G-E-E-R-T-Z, Clifford Geertz. So what's another way in which, other than a wink, that people try to communicate symbolic, meaningful things? Yes, sir?
By a variety of nonverbal language, such as their position, how they sit, how they cross their legs,
sure, so body language is a very important thing. Now, the interesting thing about this is that body language is something that many times changes with cultural context, right? Now, we know this, that if you're, for example, going to visit abroad, you realize that different cultures have different degrees of degrees of separation, right? That inches separating people who are speaking. But did you know it actually works that same way in the United States? That there are different regions of the country where there's closer physical contact and places where there's further contact. So body language is one of those important things that can communicate a whole range of different things. What else?
How they dress.
How they dress, sure. So what you choose to do. One of the interesting things that I learned is that, I recently completed a big study where I interviewed a number of prominent Americans about their religious lives. And I learned that how I dressed I had to be slightly one step ahead of the people that I was interviewing in attire because I was at a lower level, so I needed to show respect to them. But that required calibration because when I go to interview someone in Washington, D.C., I need to wear something different than when I go interview them in Silicon Valley because they're different attire norms. And if I went into Silicon Valley wearing a suit, wearing my blue suit with a white shirt like I had in Washington, D.C., I would actually get different kinds of data. Because one of the things that you're trying to do when you're culturally discerning the context is actually build a connection with the culture you're trying to understand. So you actually can bias the data you collect simply by the way in which you present yourself. It's interesting because I learned this early on, and that there were different kind of cues that I would try and draw in different types of times. And I asked my students about this. I was TAing at Princeton. And my students refer to this as dropping the P-bomb. That there would be different moments when they're going, for example, on a job interview, where they would want to let the other person know that they went to Princeton, and other times when they really didn't want them to know that. And I would say, well, you know, if they asked me where do you go to school, what would you say? And they said, well, if I wanted them to know I'm in Princeton, I said, I go to Princeton. But if I don't want them to know that, if I'm afraid it'll make the situation awkward, or they'll somehow think I must think I'm better than they are, or whatever goes with it, they say, oh, I go to school in New Jersey. And then the person says, where do you go to school in New Jersey? And then they say, oh, Central New Jersey. And eventually, you know, you sort of draw it out. And there's a lot of data that shows the way in which you sort of reveal information whenever you're trying to study something, it actually influences it. So thick and thin description are important elements to understanding the context. What we want to try and do is to describe as thickly as we can the context we're trying to study. One of the real pitfalls that most people do whenever they're trying to understand the culture is that they are not textured enough. They just gloss over important differences. And this is one of the real challenges that I think we oftentimes face. What you want to try and do is be able to tell stories as faithfully and accurately as you can. And here's the real tension. So there's a difference between what we do in the church and what we do in the academy. So let me tell you the difference. In the academy, as a sociologist, I have to employ a method that's been called critical empathy. Critical empathy, what does that mean? It means that when I'm trying to tell the stories of the religious lives of America's top leaders, I have to be critical, objective. I have to be able to point out inconsistencies and points where they don't always measure up. And if I don't bring that sort of critical hermeneutic to the task, then I'm not actually owning up to my job as a sociologist. But I also have to be empathetic to tell people stories in such a way that they recognize themselves. Frankly, this is one of the real pitfalls of my own discipline. We tend to not be very empathetic with our subjects. Most, particularly grad students, are pretty snarky in their descriptions. It's almost as if, you know, because you're a grad student, you sort of know a whole lot more. I often say grad school is sort of this process of where you're reading all these great works and your greatest contribution is to point out how very stupid and simple-minded and incomplete these particular works are. Then you get a job and you start to write your own book and you realize how brilliant those people are, how difficult it is, how much more is involved. What we want to do in the church is we don't always have to apply that same sort of critical hermeneutic, but we want to try and be as thick in our description as we can. So there are lots of different ways that you can do this. How do you actually do it? Well, number one, we need to look very carefully at what's happening and listen intently to what people are saying and not saying. So let me just apply this to a university campus. So you're trying to understand the culture of the university campus. So let's say the problem is you're trying to figure out why is it that there are, our sense is that there are a lot of Christians on this particular campus, but they're all in hiding. They don't want to come out as Christians, and so it's sort of below the surface. You want to figure out, why is that? Well, the first thing you've got to be doing there is you've got to figure out what's going on, and what are people saying, and what are they not saying? So what does that mean you have to do? How do you know what people are not saying if they're not saying it? You have comparisons. So one of the kind of fundamental ideas of cultural analysis is that you need to be able to bring comparative cases. You have to be able to say, so at Rice they're doing this, at the University of Houston they're doing this. You have to be able to sort of have some kind of comparison. So any kind of cultural work, it doesn't make a hill of beans worth of difference unless you actually have comparison case. It doesn't matter to you, for example, it wasn't meaningful for you to know that there were 4% of Americans who were atheists or agnostic until you realized that our closest counterpart, Great Britain, had 10 times that. It's the comparison that actually helps us put things into context. That's how we learn things. It's how we take in new bits of information. We relate it to existing information. That's what we've got to do with cultural analysis. Second, you want to really pay attention to where the action is taking place. So you want to actually sort of spend some time. So we call this oftentimes ethnographic observation. It just means hanging out with people and getting a chance to sort of see what they're doing. And taking your laptop or taking your notebook and trying to pay attention to that. And you're trying to draw some different comparisons. Now, so let's say you're trying to figure out why there are seemingly, you know, a decent number of Christians on your campus, but they're not willing to come out. If you're trying to figure out different comparison groups on campus, what would be some of those populations you might try and compare? Okay, different religious groups. So you might say, are the evangelical fellowships, are those students different than, say, the mainline or Catholic fellowships, right? What else? Okay, those who live on campus, those who don't, upperclassmen, freshmen, or maybe comparing graduate students to undergraduates, good. What else?
By discipline.
By discipline. So maybe it's that the folks in the sciences are much more willing to be public about their faith than those in the humanities are not, which incidentally, the data has shown that that's actually the case. You know why it is? Or at least the prevailing thought is that in the sciences, there's a greater distance between what you do in the laboratory and your espoused beliefs. Whereas in the humanities, it's assumed that all of your sort of background you're bringing to the interpretive task of your analysis. And the concern is that if you're in humanities and you're a person of faith, then that's going to bias your interpretations. Whereas the appearance is that in science, it's a pure analysis, and so it doesn't matter if you're just counting neutrons or something like that. And so what difference does it matter if you're a Christian or not? Now, we all know that's not how it works, that there's, even in science, there's a lot of interpretive framework, but that has been the sort of prevailing assumption. So trying to figure out who are the key players at drawing some of those comparisons is extremely important. And there's different sort of techniques or ways that you can sort of bring different bits of data in. So let's talk about how do you actually do this. Well, one of them is by getting people to tell their stories. Getting people to tell their stories. And this, I think, is probably one of the very best ways to understand the culture, is getting a chance for people to tell their stories, to hear motivations. And the worst thing we can do is ask questions that are leading questions that sort of don't give a chance for folks to sort of bring in lots of different parts of their background. So for example, if I say to somebody, if I go in and ask these powerful people, are you powerful? That's not a very good question. Instead, it's much better to say, can you tell me about a time when you were surprised about the influence that you had? And that's a very, that's a much better question because it gives me a chance to sort of hear their stories and for them to give me a concrete example of where you sort of will be drawing people out. There are a number of movements who have been able to take advantage over the course of the 20th century of the importance of narrative and storytelling to actually bring about cultural change. Probably the best example of this would be the gay and lesbian movement. Why has the gay and lesbian movement succeeded in bringing about cultural change over the last 30 years? It's not because they have suddenly become a majority of the population, as they have not. It's not because they have voted their people in office, because that has not happened. In fact, there's been very little legislation that's taken place. If you had to point to a public policy issue where the gay and lesbian movement had a real success, you probably would have to point to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in 1993, which was sort of a compromise, didn't really sort of help them achieve their goals. And yet, you can look, you can chart the data and see that there's a growing number of Americans who see the gay and lesbian lifestyle as a legitimate, even a you know, an appropriate lifestyle for people. Why is that? Part of it is because this particular movement has recognized the power of stories. So instead of trying to legislate their ideas, they simply try and use media to communicate sympathetic messages. So, for example, the very first openly gay character to appear on a sitcom appeared in 1977 in an episode of the TV show Soap, if you remember Soap. And then that was followed a couple of years later with some more sympathetic characters, so much so that by the 1990s, you have a TV show, Will and Grace, which becomes a top TV show on network TV, where you have a character who is gay and is actually sort of a winsome protagonist. Now, what does this do for us? Well, it allows that lifestyle to become seen as something that we actually enjoy and that we feel a connection with. Another very powerful way that the gay lesbian lifestyle has used storytelling is to tell the plight of people dealing with AIDS. So you have the movie Philadelphia, right? But which can tell the very difficult story of someone who's battling with that issue. Narrative and storytelling is probably one of the most underused methods of sort of data analysis that can help us understand the time. Yes, sir.
Very interesting. But then when the TV or the attempted TV series based on Catherine Marshall's books about the teacher in
right.
the South.
Right.
All about story, and it wouldn't take off.
Yeah, so here's the real challenge that I would say is different between, let's say, the gay and lesbian community and the Christian community, is that the gay and lesbian community recognizes the importance of showing up to support the cultural products that sort of help communicate their messages. And so they're very good at mobilizing, for example, on opening night of movie releases. And that's actually how you vote for a movie, is if you show up the opening weekend, that sort of sets the trajectory of that film. And so it's amazing to me that so few Christians actually mobilize to go to, if there's a film that sort of communicates their values, they say, oh, well, I'll go to it in a couple of weeks. You may not have a couple of weeks. It's all about that opening weekend makes a real difference. Same thing with TV shows. It's a very interesting story. I interviewed Martha Williamson, the executive producer of Touched by an Angel. Now, if you know the story, Touched by an Angel becomes one of the top shows in the 1990s for CBS. Top 10 in every market, primetime, Sunday night, wins in its time slot year after year. But it wasn't always that way. Martha tells the story how in the first year of the series, it almost got canceled. And it literally came down to two Sunday nights in which CBS said it's either going to make it or we're going to cut it. And what Williamson did, and working with a variety of different groups, is basically they tried to mobilize church groups to say, would you please try and encourage your people to watch this particular TV show because that's very critical for ratings and actually makes a difference. And that particular show was actually saved by folks showing up to support that particular cultural product. So we gotta be supportive of the stories that are out there. We gotta look for them and try and remind them. Another thing that we can do is what's called textual analysis. And this is where you know, are reading things and looking for patterns. And trying to sort of understand, either on print or online, how do you actually sort of hear what people have to say and making sense of this. So some of the ways you do this is by you looking at certain kinds of language. What are the things that the ways in which people try and frame things? And how can that sort of help you in making better sense? One of the interesting things that I learned, for example, is through textual analysis, many of the people that I interviewed who are prominent Americans who are also Christians, I asked them, tell me about the way in which your faith became public. And the, you know what the phrase was that they used most often to describe that moment? Coming out.
Huh.
Very interesting. They sort of talked about how they were had this coming out experience. And it was very different. Bruce Kennedy, for example, was the CEO of Alaska Airlines. And his sort of coming out experience occurred when he was invited to give a talk in Alaska, in his hometown. And he said, these people had known me all my life, and I really couldn't hide my faith. But I had been sort of more low-key about it. The news media didn't know about it. And there happened to be a local reporter who came to this particular gathering and heard me sort of give my Christian testimony. And then suddenly, I couldn't hide it anymore. It was sort of this experience. So looking for ways that you can sort of find connections. And one of the things that I think is very helpful to understanding your campus community is by paying attention to the campus newspaper. I think that's a really important way to sort of understand the vibe of what's going on the university campus, is by trying to see what are people writing about and what are they actually saying. And probably one of the best things to pay attention to are the ads. Ads that are there, because that's a way in which you're sort of communicating implicit messages. Another thing is what's known as participant observation. Last night, I forget her name, the woman who's the scholar of history was talking about slavery. She told this amazing story about how she's sort of a scholar activist. This is sort of in that same sort of tradition. It's where you're trying to bring in sort of your cultural discernment, but you're right in the mix of things. Now, it used to be 50 years ago that that would make you a really bad scholar. But today we recognize that participant observation actually helps a lot. You're more likely to get good data because you know the people. You can sort of pick up on things. One of the things that I say, the reason why people so often in the national media get the story about Christianity wrong is because they don't know any Christians. So they just assume that Jerry Falwell and James Dobson and Max Lucado are all the same entity. They can't pick up on nuances. I mean, sometimes they recognize that Jim Wallace and James Dobson might be different, but they can't tell the difference between James Dobson and Chuck Colson, for example, right? That requires sort of a finer calibration and understanding of which participant observation can help you to do. Another thing that I always encourage folks who are trying to really understand the campus where they are, or the community or whatever, is what is known as shadowing. And this is where you actually just sort of hang out with people and follow around where they are. One of the things that struck me among the people that I interviewed is that one of the questions I asked them is, how often has your pastor visited you in the workplace? I interviewed 360 people, and these are all serious Christians, different traditions, different experiences. And you know, of those 360 people, there was only one person who could recall their pastor visiting them in the workplace. But it was such a meaningful experience, that person could recount the story in graphic detail. He could tell me what he was wearing, what his pastor was wearing. He could tell me what his pastor said, who he introduced his pastor to, where they went. And it happened 20 years earlier. So one of the things that I think we ought to do a better job of is actually sort of get out there. If you want to understand the culture, you got to be part of it. We can't sort of be in these silos. One of my words of advice I give to my pastor friends that I heard from so many people I interview is that occasionally there'll be a sermon about ethics or workplace decision making. But oftentimes it's presented as if it's a black and white choice. Steve Reinemann, the CEO of Pepsi, told me, you know what? I never get to make choices between black and white. It only gets to my desk because it's in deep shades of gray. So you got to actually sort of get there to hear what people are saying in the experience, because if you don't, you won't actually know. So that's required for thick description. You got to get out there and sort of understand people. There's also some very interesting things you can do with social experiments. Probably one of the best stories about this is that a team of researchers, psychologists at Princeton, decided that they wanted to try and understand the effects of different cultural elements looking at the notion of being a good neighbor. So here's what they did. They set up a context in which they had recruited a homiletics professor at Princeton Seminary to assign to the class that they needed to preach a sermon on the parable of the Good Samaritan. And that this is what they were supposed to try and do. And the way that they set up this experiment is that they were going to be preaching it in an afternoon session of the class. And then what happened is this is where they introduce the dynamic. So they have half of the group that they're told to preach a sermon on the Good Samaritan, and they come in and they preach the sermon, and that's all. And then they have another half of that population. They tell them that they're going to preach on the parable of the Good Samaritan, and they call the person and say, actually, the class is not meeting at 4, it's meeting at 3:30, and you're late, it's 3:45, so we need you to hurry over, we've been waiting for you to come and preach your sermon. And so they create this social environment where the person who's supposed to preach the sermon on the Good Samaritan suddenly feels like they're under a time crunch. And they arranged it so that somewhere along the path from where that person was at that time until there was where they're going to the classroom, there was someone who needed help. And they wanted to try and see, did the person actually stop to help them or not? It's a classic social experiment. And very interesting. And what they found, as you might expect, is those people who had who got the phone call that said you're running late, they were far less likely to stop and help the person than those people who did not get that phone call. That the time crunch actually sort of influenced. So you can create all kinds of these social experiments. And it's kind of fun. There's also what we know in the social sciences known as breaching experiments. It's where you get people, it's where you do something that sort of breaches conventional norms. There are all kinds of ways you can do this. You breach norms all the time. So you walk into an elevator, instead of turning around to look at the number and acting like no one else is in the elevator, which we seem to do all the time, you instead decide to get very close to the person and just see if they can smile and see if they say anything. Or you decide you're going to keep backing up until you get very close to the person first to see if they say anything. What kind of ways you can breach norms? That you can try and get an idea. And these are different ways that you can try and understand the culture. And in fact, the breaching experiments sometimes are the most helpful ways to understand the culture. Why? Because culture is most powerful when it's taken for granted. Culture is most powerful when it's taken for granted. So it's not until you sort of force somebody to realize, hey, this is part of our culture, this is what we do, we don't get right next to somebody in the elevator, that we don't try and do that. It's not until you breach that norm, you actually sort of figure out what is it that's sort of the implicit norm that's there. There are all kinds of implicit norms, specifically as it relates to faith and how public you are, how you talk about your faith and what you try and do. For example, I learned in my research that it was far easier for me to get somebody to talk about what Jesus meant in their life if I didn't say, tell me about the importance of Jesus in your life. It was far better if I said, I hear you're a person of faith. Can you tell me about that? Why was that? Well, it's because by using the softer language of being a person of faith, it sort of opened up new possibilities. Whereas by directly invoking the name of Jesus, it sort of shut some people down. So social experiments can be a way in which you sort of get that thick description that you're looking for. You can also do in-person interviews, so sitting down with people. And the one thing I say here is that you want to try and get a better understanding of sort of a wide variety of people. If you talk to the same kind of people, you're in trouble. Focus groups are another way. It's just doing a large group interview. And then the kind of work that I did before is looking at surveys. One of the best things that I think is underappreciated is looking at the existing data about the campus of the community. There's tons of data that's out there that you actually probably have access to. Certainly if you're in a public institution, you have a lot more access to the information than if you're a private institution. But things like admissions offices and athletic offices, they collect tons of data. They give you all kinds of information. Why is it that you invite somebody to come to church and all they can talk about, that if they're not a regular churchgoer, they talk about how uncomfortable it was to sit on the pew and how they felt like they were squunched in, there wasn't a whole lot of room. And then you take that very same person, invite them to go to a football game where they sit on a metal bench that's even tighter, and they're perfectly happy. In fact, they're so grateful you invited them. Right? It's because you've got to understand the different sort of cultural contexts that are influencing. What do you think are the biggest cultural institutions that shape Americans today? What would be one of them? Biggest cultural institutions that shape Americans today?
Yeah,
television, and more broadly, media. Something else?
Pro sports. Yeah.
Professional sports. Huge industry, right? It shapes an awful, awful lot. It's so much so it trickles into, we no longer use military metaphors to talk about religious activities, like going on crusade blitzes and those kind of things. We use sports metaphors, right? It just sort of comes inculcated in. What about other institutions?
The university.
The university, although its relevance varies, right? It's probably a lot more salient for us than it is for the average American. But there is some element of that. What else?
Advertising.
A very significant influence. I interviewed a number of people in Hollywood, and the basic conclusion for them is that television is principally a delivery system for advertising. That's fundamentally, that's what it exists for, and that conditions a whole lot of the messages that we get in a particular sport. And yet, it has a tremendous influence, right? It can condition a whole variety of things, the impulses, the things that we desire. What else? Major cultural institutional influences.
Music.
Music, sure. Then it gets that larger context of media.
Social networks.
Social networks, Facebook, increasingly become important. And perhaps one that's even more fundamental than that, the family. Most formative influence on Americans is the family. That everyone has that sort of formative influence, and it comes in conditions and shapes our wants, our desires, our expectations, and we don't pay enough attention to that and looking at that. So trying to get a sense of that, those are all elements that sort of will influence the way in which you sort of understand. Now, I tell people that you got to deal with the big questions when you're trying to understand your context, the who. So who are the main actors? So at a university, it's going to be the students, the faculty, the staff, the coaches, but it's also ancillary people, right? It's the professional guilds. So I'm a sociologist. You really cannot understand me and my work unless you also understand what the expectations are among other sociologists at other institutions that I think are important. Prestige and status is extremely important. Extremely important. So it doesn't really matter what's going on at some place that I don't consider important, but if I consider Columbia University to be a very important marker, you got to pay attention to that to understand the work. So reference groups are very fundamental to that. You also have to think about the what. What actually takes place? Obviously, there's hopefully knowledge, learning going on at the university. There's a whole lot of other things going on at the university. Partying, performing, playing, all these different kinds of things condition and shape what we're doing, the what of what's going on at the university. You also have got to deal with the when. So there's big differences between what goes on in the academic year versus what goes on in the summer, as well as different times of the day. You also have to look at the where. So the different campus hotspots. What are some of the hotspots that have emerged within the last 10 years that did not exist before, that have become very important meeting places?
Starbucks.
Yeah, coffee houses, right? I mean, you can't understand university life if you don't understand the influence of these sort of coffee houses. And also there's a trend that's sort of the anti-Starbucks trend, which is we don't want to have that corporate overhead on top of us, but we want to have something that's sort of local, organic, right? So how that fits into the mix. These are all important things. So understanding the where of what's going on. And you also got to ask folks, what are you doing and why are you doing it? Why are you doing what you do? That's a question we don't actually ask ourselves very much. Why are you doing what you do? And it's actually fundamental. This is one of those sort of reaching experiments because people, we just sort of, Peter Berger and Thomas Luckman say that the way in which we come to the world we live in is it's socially constructed. We've got all this sort of culture and it's just what's handed to us. And we don't actually ask the hard questions of why am I doing what I'm doing? The real benefit, I think, of something like following Christ is it gives us space to actually think about the big questions. It gives you an occasion to sort of take stock and say, what is it I want to do with my life and why am I doing that? We need more of those kinds of things. And actually, trying to get data can be helpful. And then finally, how? You cannot understand culture unless you have paid attention to resources. You cannot understand culture unless you pay attention. And that's why those institutions that you mentioned came before you thought about family. That's why we think about advertising, we think about media, we think about pro sports, because there's so much money involved. So how that sort of fits into the mix is an important thing as well. So how do we actually sort of fit spiritual discernment into trying to understand the times in which we live? So how do we actually sort of think about that? I said that prayer's got to be at the heart of what we're doing. I like Ken Meyer's definition of culture. Culture is God's creation and what we make of it. And he uses the term make in both senses of the term. What we make of it, what we create of it, and also how we sort of interpret it, how we actually sort of make sense of that. So
that's what we're trying to do in cultural analysis and trying to get there. Culture is most powerful when it's taken for granted, and so you have to understand what is it that sort of calls people to try and be drawn out. And we have to be involved in culture because, frankly, it's part of what we are drawn to. It's the creation mandate in the creation story. Two big problems that we tend to face with cultural interpretation is making an idol of the culture that's around us and imitating. How do we, in the church, make an idol of the culture around us?
Size.
Say a little more.
Maybe a church. Better.
Okay. So bigger is better. What else? How else?
Technology.
Use of technology. Sure. It's interesting. Did you notice that most people, the sort of prevailing assumption among the sort of literati classes, people who talk on CNN, they assume that Christians are oftentimes behind the times of technology. It's not that way at all. We're actually some of the earliest adopters of new technology. Two little tidbits. Did you know that the expansion of commercial radio was first embraced by Christian communities because of radio preaching? Did you know that when cable satellites were developed in the late 70s, after the military allowed commercial satellites to be launched, there were three early adopters of satellite technology. Do you know what the three were? One was Ted Turner. With CNN. One was looking at sort of how you sort of take it to CNN is one of those. Then you've got the networks. And then the third one, not Turning Broadcasting Network, but CBN, Pat Robertson. One of the first early adopters of new technology. So, you can actually see where you've got that. So on the radio, you actually have Catholics actually were also very early adopters of using radio as a way of. Catholics have actually been very innovative with mass services, for example. And so it actually, looking on certain different episodes, on the satellite thing, it's evangelical. But if you're looking at the radio case, it's actually just a wider view. And that's why you see, for example, that churches were some of the first adopters of PowerPoint technology in our praise choruses and our sermons. And we also were some of the earliest adopters of websites technology. So did you know that actually the internet is the single largest provider of spiritual information today in the world? More people turn to the internet to get information about religious questions than any other source. So it's important to sort of see how we can actually use that in a chance of doing that. And yet, there's some real challenges with cultural discernment that we face, that is frankly we face it in the church and we face it in any kind of work we do, and that is the biases. So how do you actually discern it? I don't know if you saw this. This was a cover of the New Yorker back in about 20 years ago. And it's the view of the world from New York. And so it starts here and you sort of see, you're looking west of the world and so you have, well, here's 9th Avenue and there's 10th Avenue and then there's the Hudson River and there's a little sliver of land that's Jersey that he knows beyond there. And then there's some places out there, Chicago, Kansas City, Las Vegas, and the Pacific Ocean, and then there's China, Japan, and Russia in the far distance, right? And if you've lived in New York, you know that there is sort of some element of this, you know, that this is how we sort of view the world, it's New York is the center of the universe, and other places, China, Russia, Japan, they're sort of off there, you know, off to the end. It's interesting because the Bible talks an awful lot about this as well. We deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. So one of the great challenges that we face in trying to understand our particular culture, understanding the community where we live, is sort of how do we do that spiritual discernment without falling into these same people's traps. A couple of simple things that actually make a real difference. One is that it's always very helpful if you have folks who are keeping you honest. So I find it's most helpful if I have people who don't share my faith commitments, who are considering my sort of understanding. So if you're not in conversation with people outside of Christianity, there's no way you're going to be able to understand the culture. There's no way. This is really hard because our whole lives are oriented around sort of hanging out with people who are like us. And it makes the most sense that you want to hang out with people who share your faith commitments. I think this is particularly hard for campus ministry workers and pastors. Because your whole professional life is sort of oriented toward faith issues. Your primary constituents are people of faith or people you're hoping to bring along.
to the common people of faith, and everything sort of is oriented around that. So here's my sort of very practical suggestion I give to folks, is you have to have at least one dimension of your life where you're regularly hanging out with people who don't share your Christian commitments. You got to have one particular domain where that happens. In the life of my wife and I, we send our daughter to a special preschool at the Jewish Community Center. And I told the friends in the earlier session, it's as Jewish as InterVarsity is Christian. And so it's a whole different world. And it's very interesting because, we have a child with special needs, and it's a special needs class. And it was very interesting to hear the conversations with these other parents when Sarah Palin accepted the nomination to join John McCain's ticket as vice president. And the thing that was interesting is because it was all around these issues of what she's doing as a mother of a child with Down syndrome. Now, I've got to tell you, the conversations I have with these Jewish friends was entirely different than the conversation I was having with my friends at church. And it's because they view the world in very different ways. In many ways, the Christian friends I was talking with were sort of saying, it's important to have somebody who speaks up for those populations, and so wouldn't it be great to have somebody like that who could speak up for kids especially? And I got to tell you, as a parent with a kid in that situation, I sure would love to have somebody who would advocate for that in a very high position. I'm very much on board with that. And yet I also heard the other argument, which was from my Jewish friends who said, how can she, as the mother of a child with special needs, how does she actually have the time for another country? Because I don't even have time to check my email. And so I would have never had that conversation, never understood that whole perspective if I wasn't in conversation with those folks. So practical things. You choose a place to work out that's not at your church. So you work out at a place where it's lots of pagans. figure out something like that. Or you're involved in a book club that has nothing to do with Christianity. Or you find some kind of a group that gets you out of the Christian bubble. You got to have that sort of... Otherwise, we're going to fall prey to the very same problem. Yes, sir?
So is this place kind of like your laboratory where you don't really try to influence it, but you just use it as a cultural barometer to kind of test the ideas and things?
Well, I try not to put my sociologist hat too much when I'm hanging out with people. My wife always said she's glad that she's much happier that I'm a sociologist, not a psychologist. We try to move the dial among our Jewish friends, and we try in some ways to be a winsome witness for them. But I will say, this experience, we've been in the school for the last 3 years, it has entirely changed my perspective on a lot of the Christian subculture. It really has. Because I never quite understood why it was that so many Jews were afraid of so I wrote a book called Faith in the Halls of Power. That is a terrifying title to some of the people that we hang out with. It's because the subtitle is How Evangelicals Join the American Elite. And I say to them, well, why is it upsetting to you? Because Jews have been in the elite for a long time. You're running Hollywood, you're running Wall Street. Why is that alarming? And they said, well, you guys constitute, let's say, a third of the adult population. We're 2%. We're afraid of the tyranny of the majority. We're afraid that you're going to sort of take over. And in some ways, trample over our rights or our opportunities to express ourselves. Getting that kind of rich, thick description by hanging out with people, it gives you a whole different perspective. You cannot understand the world unless we're sort of hanging out with them. Yes, sir.
I mean, two of the terms that come in anthropology is, would be ethnocentrism and cultural relativism. And just the critical role of seeing how people make sense of the world in their own terms and not bringing our own ideas of what things mean to the analysis at the beginning.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the things that we can bring to, if we're more thoughtful about it, I think we can do a lot better job at it. It's frankly a matter of just being aware. It's being aware of how our own sort of perspective can be that ethnocentric perspective, and that we can also forget that you've got a lot more history that's involved there. I never understood one of my advisors for grad school, it's this wonderful woman, Suzanne Keller. And Suzanne, she's great. She's a secular Jew, and so she knows nothing about the evangelical world. And she knew that I was a person of faith, but she didn't even really understand the difference between Protestant Catholics. She used to say to me, if this faculty thing doesn't work out, I know you can do really well at the Vatican. I was like, I'm not Catholic, but she says, that's a technicality. But I don't understand Suzanne's life. I don't understand the way in which she understands evangelicals until I come to understand that she came from a family that was part of the elite of Vienna in 1937, and that they were forced to flee, and that there was an evangelical Protestant family who was threatening to out them. And that basically she and her family had to flee to Greece. I don't understand her whole orientation to Rick Warren or Jimmy Carter or George W. Bush. I don't understand it until I know that part of the story, right? So you gotta be able to hear people's stories if people don't understand that. And I think that's one of the challenges that we face, the biases that can come up, but frankly, the real opportunities. Now, also you have a real challenge because oftentimes our friends are saying, how many squares are up here?
More than 16.
A lot of people assume it's 16. But then somebody smart in the back of the room has seen this before and said it's more than 16, right? So it is indeed more than 16. But when you first look at it, you see 16 squares, right? But actually, there are more than 16. How many squares are up there? 21. Gosh, I feel like I'm in an auction or something. 22, 24. I hear 25. Anyone go higher than 25? 25. 30? Who says 30? Do you see them? Come show us. Where are the 30?
You got 16, you have 17, 18.
Hold on. So we got 16, and then we've got these four, 17, 18, 19 and 20, okay.
Then we have 21.
21 by these four.
22. 23. 24. 25.
So doing a 3x3 instead of a 2x2, right? So
25. 26.
Yes. 27. Yes.
28.
Doing the 3x3s again, yes.
29,
the 3x3, and
four.
The big one is 30. Very good. Ian, thank you very much. Yes. Our natural instinct whenever you're looking at culture is to sort of make the judgment immediately, right? You sort of size somebody up. That's how we do things. Average American gets their first impression of somebody in 7 seconds. They form their impression. If you're a speaker, the audience makes their decision within 2 minutes of whether they're going to like you or not like you. We rely on things very quickly. I hope you like me. But we rely on these things very quickly. But actually, the more you study it, the more complex. And the interesting thing is that I did this with a group of students. And I said, what's the most number you see? And that somebody said 25, 26, 28, 30, 32, 36, 41. I mean, I started, and I said, really, where are the 41 squares? There's not just 30, there's 30. So you have to sort of be willing to attend, but also study the information as carefully as possible. So whenever we're trying to understand the culture, but different kinds of data, you got to make different decisions. So there's different kind of cost, opportunity cost. So an interview can give you some opportunities, but personal observation gives you something different. Survey gives you something entirely different. Most of the time, the best research that's done out there involves a combination of different things. So you try and mix and mingle different things. I'll give you a great example. So I'm currently doing research on a program called the White House Fellowship. White House Fellowship has been around since 1964, created by President Johnson. And it's this amazing program that takes talented, bright, amazing people who are in their 30s to go and work for a cabinet secretary for a year. And then they take the experience and go back to whatever they were doing before. And I and some really famous alumni, Colin Powell's an alum, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Wesley Clark, the CEO of CNN, Tom Johnson, the CEO of JCPenney, Mike Goldman, a whole variety of really extraordinary people. And this fall, I did a survey of this group. There's 610 former fellows who are alive today. And we got a great 75% response rate, so I was very excited about that. Incidentally, any survey, always pay attention to the response rates. Most people who do surveys don't want to report the response rate because they're really low, they're really bad.
Robert Putnam is a political scientist at Harvard, and he's done a variety of statistical modeling. And his basic conclusion is that sort of a minimum threshold of validity of a national survey that he feels comfortable with, and that a number of other scholars agreed, is that about 38%. So you can get a 38% response rate. He's going to feel, he feels confident in it. In most academic journals, in sociology at least, if you get a response rate of 50%, you have a good chance of being published. If it's lower than, say, 30%, it's not going to get published in the top-tier journals. Do you know what most, the average response rate of surveys are conducted that are reported in the national media is? 4%. 4%. And so, what does that mean? It means that you contacted 100 people, and 4 of them completed the survey, and 96 of them did not. Yes, sir? Separate. So the plus or minus is known as the margin of error, right? And that's typically based upon the number of respondents, not the response rate. So if you have 100 respondents and you're trying to figure it, the plus or minus range is let's say plus or minus 9 percentage points. 1,000, it's at 3 percentage points. Most national polls are about 1,000 individuals. Included. And that's why normally it's in the confidence area, it's plus or minus 3%. But the response rate is the big secret. It's the iceberg nobody wants to talk about in social science. And we are the worst of it in the church. We are the worst. We sort of hear a statistic and then we say, well, it must be gospel. But what you don't realize is that you had a 3% response rate for that question. So the data is really, really bad. So you want to sort of mix it up. So I had these surveys that we did and I was really excited.
You're saying it's bad, but they're uncertainty is 3% of the thousand. How can you say it's bad?
It's not, because subsequent analysis shows that actually you can get very different responses. The confidence that you have, the confidence interval, the plus or minus percentage, actually does not reflect the degree of bias that you have with having such a small response rate. What that means is that the empirical studies show that if you have a 4% response on a survey, give the very same survey to the same population, and you get a 60% response, you get very different pictures. Very different pictures.
Is there a plus or minus?
Sorry?
It
should, but it does not. It's a whole different. The plus or minus sort of gives us the appearance that we're actually getting something statistically relevant, but it's only plus or minus within that population. So it's only of that 4% that you surveyed, you have that kind of confidence. And we suggest that it's true for the rest of the American population, but the data doesn't actually support that. So I did the survey of these White House fellows, and then I decided to pair it with doing interviews. Because I wanted to see, do I get different kinds of information? And you get whole different pictures, right? So when you ask a survey question, people are going to say one thing. Then you ask them to sort of fill it out and tell their story. It's very, very different. Why don't we just all do interviews? Why don't we just do that? It's because it's hard to interview 1,000 people. So a survey allows you to sort of compress that information. But the best is sort of to try and combine. So one of the things I sort of advise people is to try and look for different ways of combining. Say, if you're trying to do cultural analysis or discernment, that's one of the best ways.
Sorry, I mean, last thing, why do you have short for observation in terms of amount of time?
Let's see. Oh, because you can do, because oftentimes it's related to the scope of the study. So that you, you're not relying upon other individuals to collect the data. You're simply relying, typically as an observer, it's just you. So whereas doing the personal interview, you can oftentimes take a very long time because you're waiting to get the interview from the other person. Whereas observation doesn't require that degree of participation. Same thing with the survey is that you often got a larger apparatus of collecting the data.
But if you're doing an ethnographic observation, obviously,
yeah,
it's going to take a lot.
That's right. Well, one of the things that you can do with, so here I'm not just speaking observation or ethnographic observation in academic sense, but more sort of how we apply it in the church. So a lot of times, what I encourage people to do is to visit their Starbucks at 6 p.m. 3 days in a row to try and observe the different kinds of people that happen to be there. It's more related to the individual and sort of the scope of the study. If you're trying to understand the culture of Columbia University, that takes a whole different kind of time. Exactly right. So, the other thing to keep in mind is that there's a whole range of what we call non-representative methods that passes for real good data that's really crap. So, you need to just be aware of that. So, when we have these things that are
flip out mail-in surveys and taking it on where you log in to do it, or also this whole idea of where you're going to just interview the people who happen to be in the airport or happen to be at the mall, that you're not getting very good information. No, you're not getting it from folks who can give you too much helpful information. There are a whole range of new things that are coming out that I think are really helpful. And I'll just mention something that I picked up on in my my last study that I think is really helpful, which is called signaling behavior. I found that Christians who were in these powerful positions were much more likely to bear witness to their faith, not through direct evangelism, but instead by sort of dropping hints along the way. And one of the best examples of this is, I mentioned my professor, Suzanne Killer, and she said, Michael, have you ever gone to Renaissance Week? I said, no, Renaissance Weekend, sort of a by invitation only crowd. It became famous in the 90s because Bill and Hillary Clinton had been going to it for a number of years. Meets all around the country, but the big gatherings over New Year's in Charleston. And it's sort of a very elite crowd. Business people, Supreme Court justices go, members of Congress go, a number of sort of titans of industry. And Suzanne, she's the first woman to get tenure at Princeton. She was an icon. When it happened, she made the front page of the New York Times. She's married to a guy who had an endowed chair at Harvard Law School. So they're sort of like the celebrity academic couple. So unlike us peons, she actually gets invited to Renaissance Weekend. And anyway, she said to me, I think you ought to go there, because I think there's a whole lot of God talk around there, but I don't really know what it means. And so Suzanne arranged for my wife and I to get invited to go to Renaissance Weekend, which was great. And we met. And she was right. There's tons of God talk around. But you got to know how to pick up on it. So Gracie Nelson, her husband's a senator from Florida, gets up to give a talk at a plenary address. And she doesn't say, Jesus means the world to me, and let me tell you why. She says, you know, there came a point in my life when I really wanted to explore the deeper meaning, the deeper existential questions. And I found the writings of C.S. Lewis to be a profound influence. So she drops C.S. Lewis as a way of sort of signaling a whole literature that's out there, right? And if you know who Lewis is and what difference he makes, then you pick up on it. Those kind of signals are all over the place. In trying to understand. Did you know, for example, you remember the song from the 70s that Debbie Boone sang, You Light Up My Life? Did you know that that was actually intended as a praise song? That the you in that song was intended as God? Pat Boone was the one who told me that. That's amazing sort of signals that happen to be out there. I said, well, I've never picked up on. That's one of the challenges, that if the audience doesn't pick up on the signals, then it doesn't really work. You gotta have folks who actually know what it is. Another thing is that a very interesting thing that I encourage my friends in ministry to do, to be thinking about, is a new technique called photo elicitation. What you do is you tell people, I'd like you to go and give them a disposable camera and say, would you mind taking five pictures of places that are sacred or meaningful for you? And have them actually take pictures of it. And then you say, I'm doing this for sort of a project, and then I'd like you to talk about it. And so you meet them for coffee, and they bring you these pictures, and you can learn a whole lot about what they consider to be sacred and meaningful. It opens up sort of a conversation, sort of a novel approach, but it's something that Nancy Hammerman at Boston University has been doing, which I think is fantastic. And then also looking at things like Facebook and social networking, which opened up a whole new range of possibilities. I'm not really good at this. I'm on Facebook, but I exist primarily to accept people as friends. I don't do anything else. So I don't know, who are these people who can say, I'm on my way to dinner, you know? I'm folding laundry. Yeah. I don't know, how do you have time to consider about that?
But they do.
So these are different ways that you can sort of understand that. The key thing about sort of getting started is that you want to try and use the data that's out there to try and make sense. Rely upon the data that's available. The internet can help you with that. Look for a hook to try and build a conversation with somebody, building that rapport. It's helpful to have a camera, say a paper and pen, so you can ask the kinds of questions. This is a picture. That's the seal for the White House Fellows Program. And I was literally in their office, and I realized I didn't have I wanted to sort of understand the sort of institutional context. And they have this sort of plaque-like thing, this medallion for the program. Just took a picture with it on my iPhone. So looking at different things being sort of present and looking for folks who can give you different perspectives. It's also helpful if you can count things. It gives you a sense of greater confidence if you can feel like you're sort of counting instances or elements. And oftentimes, you got to allow a lot of extra time because it takes a while. Some of the people that I interviewed, I got the interview because I was willing to wait for them. One person I was willing to wait a year to do the interview, but it was a fantastic interview. So having a way in which you can sort of make it a long-term project of cultural analysis, that's a, sort of a big project in trying to do it. So looking for a particular cultural artifact, this is one of the best things that I do for my students is I teach a class called Elites and Society. And what I do is I take the wedding pages from the New York Times and I ask them to tell me, look for the ways in which people signal what's important to them. And it's, the wedding pages of the New York Times, if you've not checked it out, it's pretty. It's a good sociological project. Because I don't know who these people are that get selected to be in there, but they are running the world, their parents ran the world, their children will run the world, they come from all these sort of celebrated experiences. So looking for something that sort of gives you a hook to try and build connections, and then have a question that allows you to frame it. Last little bit of sort of knowledge from academic stuff, and then we'll have a more good conversation. Wendy Griswold is this great sociologist at Northwestern. He says there are four things that you got to attend to whenever you're looking at cultural analysis. You got to pay attention to who actually creates, so what is it that they make? Then you got to pay attention to who's their audience? What is it that they're trying to, you know, who are they trying to reach? You got to look at the actual object that they've created, and then you got to pay attention to the wider social context. You got to try and make sense of it. If you're starting a church, launching a new ministry, trying to come up with a research question, these fundamental things you gotta grapple with. It's how we actually understand the times. It's how we understand the culture. So the creator, the recipients, the object, the social world. That's how you actually do it. The best part in the process is that the hardest part of what we're trying to do, trying to understand the times, are things that we are already well prepared for, which is you know what you're trying to look for, and you're trying to apply the information once it's been collected. The thing that unites us here today is the gospel. That's sort of our point of common departure. And what we're trying to do is to try and make better sense of the culture into which God has placed us. There are some very alarming, disturbing trends. Things that I'd say are quite problematic about American culture. I'm quite concerned about the hookup culture that we see on America's college campuses. I think that's a real problem. I'm very concerned about the seeming meritocracy, which gives way to an increasing perfectionism that we have in the disciplines. So you get more higher achievement because you have a more perfect academic record, because you have a more perfect professional trajectory, and we sort of reward making an idol of the work that we do. And I find that to be problematic. I'm really bothered by the consumerism that we see in our culture. In my opinion, the besetting sin of American Christianity is just how materialistic we are. American Christians are in as much debt as non-Christians are. American Christians have as much credit card debt, have as little savings, and really cannot be differentiated from other folks. And there's a wonderful new book out called Passing the Plate, which looks at the giving habits of American Christians. The good news is that Christians give a lot more than other people. They're much more likely to give it their money, their time, physical needs being met. The bad news is that they're really stingy. You know what the average Christian gives away on an annual basis? 2%. 2% of their income. So we've got a long way to go. But the good news is that we serve a God who can actually help us understand the times and know what to do. And I don't know if this is helpful for you or not, but what they asked me to do was to give you just a sense of some of the things that we try to do in the social sciences and try to better understand the cultural context and try to make sense of what American society is like, and also then applying that with a spiritual frame trying to make sense. So, those are some of the things that I wanted to share. What questions do you have? Things that I can answer. Yes, sir.
You spoke of the survey of the fellows, and then getting a very different data and how different.
I didn't get different answers, but you get a lot more texture and depth. So, for example, you ask, one of the things that we ask them is, who was the adult who before, this is a great question to ask people, who was the adult who had the most profound influence on your life before you turned 25? So who was that person? And we ask that question in the survey.
But in an interview, it gives me a chance to sort of follow up and find out, why is it that your grandfather was more influential than your father or your mother? What was it about that? And you sort of hear people's stories. It gives you a chance to sort of fill it out with a lot more depth. Yes, sir.
So cultural discernment, as you described, it seems like a task which could potentially consume one's entire life. In what circumstances would you suggest engaging in it? How often, how intensively, for what end, and does that vary by what position?
Oh, yeah, good. Well, the main thing that I would say, and I think that the context is that, I want to say this, we in the church are very ambitious, and we have big, bold goals. And it seems to me that we would be better served if we did a little more market research before we struck out on some of those objectives. And it seems to me that we would actually have a more winsome witness, and we have a better chance of achieving our objectives if we did a little more market research. And so the moments when I think that we ought to do more of this sort of cultural discernment is when you have a big idea or a vision, and you want to actually change something. That's really, I think, the context of what we're trying to do this afternoon, is to say, if you've got something, a new ministry you want to launch, or a new initiative you're trying to explore something, it's really important to sort of do the due diligence. Because that's what everybody else does. But the church is actually the last institution to actually use the sort of tools of cultural discernment, even though we like to think of ourselves as very hip and savvy with the culture. The problem is that we're really not. And we don't actually know those biases, the blinders that we have. And so my encouragement to you is to be doing this when you're trying to do something new to sort of push the new agenda.
Yeah. This is a question that may pick up a little bit on what you were doing previously.
Yeah.
But just curious a little bit about your view of norms that might guide some of this research happening with elites, with those in power, with sort of heavy hitters. As you've done one book already, with your engagement in Second Enterprise.
Yeah.
What are some norms that guide your study of them and having them? What motivations are used after them?
Oh, that's very nice, Josh. Well, so the reason why I'm really interested in power is because in the social sciences, we tend to say stratification is really important, but we only study down. We only pay attention to the down and out. We very, very rarely pay attention to the people in the higher positions. And I think it's because, A, we're intimidated by them, and B, we can't get access. So, it's just much easier. And also, it's a very different dynamic. So I wrote this book, and I made the decision I was going to send a copy of the book to every person I interviewed. And I decided that because I said some really nice, wonderful things about some people, but I had the hermeneutic of critical empathy. So I pointed out when there were inconsistencies. One person, I won't name names, whom I interviewed, I asked him a question about whether evangelicals were made fun of in the White House. I did this interview while he was serving in the White House, and he said to me, no. And I said, well, I've just heard that sometimes they get, they're sort of made fun of, or, some joking. I'm just curious, has that ever happened? He said, no, absolutely not. So I did that interview in 2003. In 2006, in the meantime, this person left government, and this person wrote a book. And the book was a big success. It was on 60 Minutes and different things. In that, he revealed that indeed evangelicals have been called nuts and crazies and kooks and different things like that. So when I wrote my book, I had to at least point out the fact that here's what he said to me in 2003, and here's what he wrote in 2006. And I don't make a judgment about why they do it or not do it or different things like that, but I just put that out there. Well, he and I were speaking at a conference together at Yale, and he cornered me. He said, I don't like that you did this. And he said, how could you do it? And I said, well, David, if you would just, Bob or Sam or something. I forgot what I was doing. Okay, this person, I said, if you, why did you give the answer you did? And he said, well, I'm in the White House. What do you expect? And I said, well, you could have said no comment.
or I'll answer it off the record. You know, you have that option. I said, but you could have given me one answer and then called me next week when you left government and said, you know what, that's not true. Let me tell you the real story. Or when I sent you the transcript for you to review for accuracy, you could have changed it. And there are a whole range of things. But I said, you didn't. You had 2 years. So I had to point that out. So I decided to sort of send the book to people because I wanted them to get the news from me and not from somebody else. And it's a very interesting dynamic because most of the time in social sciences, you don't quote people by name. And if you do, it's not people who are more powerful than you. They deserve pressure and all kinds of things. So there were a couple of people who didn't like what I wrote. But I decided that I'd rather sort of be upfront and honest and sort of give it out to them. And my hope is that, I mean, really what I want is I'd like us to sort of understand this group. I want to sort of demystify the people who are running the country. Because the more I get to know them, the more I realize that they're actually very, very like you and me. But we need to hear their stories, and we need to sort of tell their stories and get a better sense. Probably one of the best examples of this is that most people assume that people who rise up to power are sort of the self-made man or woman, and it's an individual story. It's never an individual story. It's never an individual story. Malcolm Gladwell has a very good book that's recently come out, Outliers, and it got torched in the New York Times, but I did too, and so I think it's a good book. And one of the things that he says there is that Bill Gates was born at the right time, and he went to the right school. He went to a prep school in Seattle that had a computer when nobody else at a prep school had a computer. And he was able to sort of practice and master computer programming as a 13-year-old in a way that nobody else in the country was doing, or not many other people were doing. And so telling sort of people's stories, I think, is very important. And I'll just say one thing that I do with interviews that I think applies not just to studying the leads, but I think, frankly, applies to what we ought to be doing in the church, and that is you have to build bridges to bring people along and to get them to tell your story. So I will start with the difficult, hard questions that I ask every person I interview. I ask them about the scandals they've done, the allegations. I mean, these are powerful people, so there's always dirt. But I don't start with the dirt. Instead, I try and figure out how to connect with them as a human. I try to sort of get their story, get them talking to me for about 30 minutes. And then I bring out the dirt from minutes 30 to 45, and we sort of hash into it, and I say, and I do the Barbara Walters technique, which is, some have said about you, you know. I didn't say it, but some have said this. You know, how do you respond to that? And I also ask a question, and then I just smile and wait until they respond. One of my favorite things is I ask people how much money they give away to different Christian causes. And the person says, like the dollar amount? And I said, yes. And I smile. And it worked. People would then say, oh, I don't really want to tell you that. And I'll say, well, is it 6 figures, 7 figures, or 8 figures? And they say, oh, no. I don't know, maybe 6 figures. And I say, oh, so is it low 6 figures? And eventually they say, I give away 120,000, you know, and eventually get the information. So. Yes, sir.
The great Chicagoan Studs Terkel recently died. A lot of what you said in Great Affinity to Terkel's methods, Terkel's writings, do you see that connection? I mean, is it conscious, unconscious? Can you speak to that a little?
It's unconscious, except to the extent that a lot of what we do in the social sciences has been influenced by what's known as the Chicago School, and particularly with ethnographic observation. But it's not something I'm directly trying to allude there. But what we're really trying to do, what I've tried to do this afternoon, is sort of to paint with a couple of stories and then just some practical tips of how is it that we're trying to better understand the culture that we live in, and how do we sort of apply a spiritual framework in analyzing that and trying to sort of get a better sense. I don't think I've done justice to sort of study the process of spiritual discernment. So you get this data, and then you got to make sense of it. And one of the intriguing things is that two Christians can look at the very same data and come to very different conclusions. I often said, so my friend George Gallup, I used to work for, and George Barna, who is a wonderful man, they can look at the exact same data, and George Gallup tends to be seen more of a sunny side kind of person and sees the, 40% are going to church, and George Barnes can say that 60% are not, right? And so you can look at it from, you can have that sort of kind of similar, same data, look at a different framework, and I think that's just sort of where you sort of show what it is that sort of you bring to the interpretive class. Yes, sir.
I have questions. The first one is, my understanding is that you are able to get access to many of the persons which were interested in interviewing. So what strategy did you use for that? How many of them reduced.
Yeah.
I suppose it's used the fact that there were Christians and who were interested in shedding more light on the other movement.
That's right. So I had an 84% response rate among the total population of people I tried to interview, which was pretty good. And I think the reason why I succeeded is because I depended upon every friend, acquaintance, family network that I could possibly find. There are people in this room who helped me get interviews. And so I called upon as many people to try and help me make connections, which I think is very important. And trust is the single greatest way in which you'll actually be able to get data. So there were a couple of times early on when I noticed that trust was very important. One interview that I did, the person said something, and then he said, you know, I really don't want to go there anymore. And I could have continued to push, and probably if I were putting on my hard social scientist hat, I probably would have. But I also recognized that it was a personal issue, and he really didn't want to continue on this particular topic, and so I didn't. And I scored a lot of points because I was willing to sort of wait and hear the story. As it turned out, on that particular interview, we came back around to that whole series of issues. I was able to get it, but I wasn't pushy about it. I was willing to wait. And that's the other thing. I think I got access because I was willing to wait. Sometimes it's a matter of being in the right place at the right time, and so being able to ask for the interview when you really need it. But most of the time, it was being able to draw upon relational networks. My big break came because I went to college with a guy named Joel Vestal. He's a good friend of mine. And his dad, Dan Vestal, runs an organization called the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, which is in Atlanta. And I knew that Dan Vestal was very good friends with Jimmy Carter. And so I called every person I knew. And so I called Dr. Vestal and said, I really would like to interview former President Carter. Would you be willing to put in a good word, sort of vouch for me, tell him, you know, I'm a good guy trying to do solid research. So I never said, I'm going to portray you in a positive light. I never, you know, said, I'll only take what you want. I'm a sociologist. I'm going to be objective, but I'm going to be fair. And I think fairness is something that, because of time demands, journalists are not always as fair as they ought to be. And because I wasn't a journalist, I think that opened up possibilities. So Jimmy Carter, so Dr. Vestal said, I'll try, but I don't think it'll result in anything. A day later, I get a telephone call from President Carter's office. It's his schedule, and she said, we hear that you'd like to do an interview with President Carter. Would you like to come down next week? I said, next week? No, I'm not ready. You've written 23 books, and I got to read them all. and I did. I read every one of his books. But I think being able to get that interview early on, and then I just learned that elite research works well with name dropping. And so whenever I would try and get an interview, I'd say, well, a number of people participate. President Carter last week agreed to be in the study. And that created legitimacy, which I think helped a lot as well. Yes, sir.
Some of the techniques you've been describing are beginning to be applied across cultures as well. I have in mind, for example, leadership profiling,
sure,
or world value surveys and how we administer them. Could you give a comment on that? I know you don't necessarily do it, but are you optimistic on these techniques being applied across?
I am. I'm very optimistic. And the World Value Survey is probably one of the better examples of that. There are a number of really smart people who have been working on trying to figure out how they can take global cultures and provide comparison groups. So asking the same questions with the same kind of data and being able to draw that. And I have done a little bit of cross-national comparative work between Europe and the U.S. And I have a good bit of confidence, and I'm actually quite encouraged by seeing things. It helps, actually. Two things have helped us. One is that we have more international graduate students in our departments today, which gives us a whole different perspective, both in helping us come up with the right questions and also administering the kind of data collection we want to do. And second is that the mobility that we have, where we have more people doing collaborations across continents, actually has been very helpful in that cross-pollination of ideas. So I'm pretty optimistic. Yes, sir.
Not being a social scientist, it seems to me that an inherent danger in doing this type of research is that you could take people and use them as a means to an end. That you could take them and just say, well, I need to take this data, so I'm just going to use people to get the data to do that. Do you see that as a danger in this type of research?
I do. And I'll tell you just sort of what I personally have done to try and sort of stem that tide a little bit.
is that, so I got to interview some amazing people, and I decided to get into the practice that I would pray for the people the day that I approached them for an interview. And I didn't pray, God, you know, please get them to say yes to give an interview. But I prayed that the Lord would bless them and bless their families. And if I knew something about them, I tried to pray about those particular issues in their life. And then I would pray for them the day I did the interview. And then I tried to pray, I don't know if I did this in every single case, but I tried to pray in any, whenever I had sort of communication, I would say a brief prayer for the person as just a sort of way of sort of lifting them up to God. Now that's, you know, I don't know if that super spiritualizes it, but what it did for me is it sort of softened my heart and humanized them in a very real way. It's really hard to objectify somebody you pray for. And I found that that was a really helpful way. I think that probably helped me in doing a better job as a sociologist, because I cared about them as a person, not just as a leader. Maybe last question, yes, sir.
Why do you think Christians have been reluctant to do this? Often Christians have been reluctant to do this.
I think that Christians, I think that there are a couple of things that are at work. One is pride. We think we understand the culture because we understand ourselves, and we sort of impose that on the wider culture. And frankly, we've seen, particularly outside of the Christian community, a lot more cultural change over the last two generations than inside. So the change has been much more dramatic outside, and we just aren't attuned to that. And I also think we tend to do what's most comfortable. This is a human nature. And to do this kind of cultural discernment takes effort and energy and time. And, you know, you can't do it, Silas. You can't do it for everything. So you got to sort of choose strategic moments. And I think that anything that takes time and energy sometimes, we don't actually, we're not willing to get expensive. It's been great being with you all. Thank you very much.
Let's thank Michael Lindsay one more time. He's been presenting since 1:30 this afternoon. I think it's fair to say that everybody's very interested in what he has to say, except for the fire safety officer at the hotel. She has people out in the other room watching today. So next thing on our agenda today is dinner. So enjoy.